Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us while you're probably in parallel watching the Olympics. We're not missing Olli Schmidt. He's actually sitting next to me, but we thought we'd speed things up given other priorities. He's obviously listening in and happy to answer any of the detailed questions that you might have. We tried to keep it mercifully short today, so spend the roughly next half hour to lead you through our Q2 numbers and then move on to Q&A. Before we go into the second quarter number, I'd like to provide you a little bit of a background on where we're headed for the full year. The 6 months performance for the group has been very, very good. Revenue stood at 55.2 billion. The operating profit relative to the 6 months of 2011 is up 18.5% to 4.7. Net income is even up almost 40% to 2.8, and our capital position remains very strong. We've provided you with one slide summarizing the 6 months numbers on page number 4, and you see improvement on all critical KPIs and across all segments, and that's why we're very pleased overall with the 6 months results. Now, what are the details for the second quarter? And I'll begin on page number 6 with the key messages. We had revenues up 2.5 percentage points to 25.2 billion, operating profit up to 2.4 billion, net income up to 1.3, and yes, you will see capital still strong, and particularly we have been further de-risking in the eye of the storm. We want to remain very strong, and so we have further divested risky position, particularly in the financial sector. Page number 7 gives you an overview, as usual, on the development of revenues, operating profit, and income over the quarter, and give a nice picture of very solid numbers, even in a timeline comparison. Shareholders' equity, page number 8, is basically flat, despite the fact that we've paid out more than 2 billion in dividends in the last quarter. The key additions have been net income 1.2 billion and around 600 million of foreign exchange earnings that are in the equity side. The conglomerate solvency on page number 9 is up another 3 points relative to the end of the first quarter, and we remain fairly shock resistant. On the economic solvency side, page number 10, we saw a decline of 20 points. We have taken all of the model movements in the first quarter. We spent a lot of time in the last call to explain to you what we've done. A number of the things being actually taking a more cautious view, for example, on VIF transferability, on having more strict interest rate shocks, and moving to a more what we believe the new environment will look like. We've refrained from any more changes to the model this quarter, and this shows you the sensitivity. Now, why has that been there a 20-point sensitivity? It's 10 points from lower AFR and 10 points from higher capital requirements. On the AFR decline, please remember that 1.7 billion was because of the redemption of the hybrid capital that we've done that explains the majority of the movement here, and we feel very comfortable in this environment to have called the debt as you expected in difference to what others have done and remain a very reliable fixed income issuer. On the other hand, required funds have moved up due to lower interest rates, higher implied volatilities, and obviously lower policyholder participation in case of stress scenarios. That's driving the numbers. We still feel comfortable with the capitalization in this environment of record low rates that we have never seen. So let's move on to the group number starting at page number 12, where you see the revenue development by the segments. P&C, very nice growth with more than 5%. Life and health, minus 0.9%. We'll talk about that. We are focusing on maintaining margins here and not on top line. And asset management continues to power ahead, 14.9% growth, a significant part, of course, related to foreign exchange movements. On the other hand, U.S. dollar earnings are what we need at this point in time, and as you know, asset management is about cash. Page number 13 gives you the movements on operating profit. I'll spend some time to explain the property casualty numbers. The most important driver here is prior year movements. Last year, we had runoff gains on a number of items, in particular, WTC, This year, we had negative runoff from the Thai flood like the rest of the industry. That explains the vast majority of the movements. Life and health is ahead of plan, actually, with 821. The more normalized number would have been around 700 million. Here, gains from selling the Hartford debentures have increased the investment income, and asset management is doing truly well, operating profit up 20%. Corporate and other is in and on plan. Therefore, let's move to the non-operating items, page number 15. A couple of comments here. You've probably seen the second quarter was not nice to equity, so we had 200 million of equity impairments. On the other hand, the realized gains and loss position has improved relative to the prior year, where we saw a write-down in particular on debt securities for the in form of Greek sovereign bonds that we've been taking last year. The number was then 326, if you may remember, and then we have a few others that added up to the 366 that you see here. Interest expense is nothing to comment on. It's in plan, is on plan. On the fully consolidated private equity investments, we've taken a 40 million charge on Selecta. On the restructuring charges, we had two significant investments in this quarter. Number one, we continue to right-size and focus our Allianz Global Investor operation, particularly in the U.S. That's producing positive results, as you will see later, and we've taken some restructuring charges in Germany in order to right-size our bank assurance operations. Acquisition-related expenses were very low for the quarter, no B shares to be purchased, and the other items are not really meaningful. I just would like to point out, despite the realized gains that you saw, that the unrealized gains and losses on fixed income have actually increased another roughly 1 billion. Now, let's move on and focus on the segments, and I'd like to talk about P&C in particular. Page number 19 gives you the key messages. Again, revenues up 5%, operating profit at 1.1 due to prior year impact. And our combined ratio for the quarter is 97.4 with 1.7% net cat and 2.1 favorable net runoff. Now, page number 20 gives you an overview of the revenue development. What is really nice is that we're growing across the portfolio. Except for Spain, here the economic environment is terrible and we're doing really, really well, not just in revenue share, but particularly in terms of profitability. In Eastern Europe, the situation is impacted by the cleaning of the portfolio we had in Russia on selective loss-making contracts and health insurance. That's been said correctly. The combined ratio is back where it needs to be, and some MOD claims that had to be right-sized. In every other market, we are growing very significantly, and we're very happy to report that we're growing both in terms of higher prices, that's about 1.4 percentage points, and higher volume, that's 1.8%. In terms of combined ratios, let's move to page 22. The key items are, and I've listed, while overall net cat remains within budget for the second quarter, we still had a number of our businesses that were affected. Just to mention Germany, where we had hailstorms, particularly at the end of June. We had the earthquake in Italy that has not just hit the Italian operations with 3.6 points, but also AGCS that had significant losses on top of the U.S. tornado losses they had in the second quarter. So net cat was significant again for our large corporate business. In addition, it is to be mentioned that we have still reserve strengthening and at Fireman's Fund. I've mentioned that in the past, and we already had question, what is the outlook? I cannot exclude further additions to reserves as we continuously review them for the rest of the year. We're particularly looking at workers' compensation. The review is due at the end of the third quarter. Now, in terms of accident year loss ratio, please turn to page number 23. We stand at 71.5. That's up relative to the last year, but slightly down relative to the prior quarter. And particularly without net cat, it's very important to understand that the ex-net cat accident year loss ratio has gone down below 70% now. Now, the development relative to the prior year, we split out on the lower left-hand side, and I've taken the credit insurance in a separate bucket to show you that the most economic sensitive loss ratio has moved up. We see a lot of claims frequency now in Southern Europe and partially also in Germany, which indicates that the economic environment is deteriorating. The price increases are balancing out severity and frequency increases relative to prior year. We should see more positive development in the next few quarters as the higher prices should lead to lower claims ratios. Our runoff ratio is lower than expected because of the negative runoff out of Thailand. Adjusted for that, it should be more around 3% for the quarter. Now, in terms of expenses, please turn to page number 24. Our expense ratio is flat at 28% and stable across all of the components from admin to commissions. And again, we should see over time an improvement here with the top line effects at least giving us some scale effects on the admin side. What is happening on investments? Page 25 shows you that our average asset base is growing significantly, which helps us to offset the decline in the fixed income yields, which you can see on the right-hand side, slowly but surely coming in. So we are able to maintain stable investment returns, which you can take from page 26. Our interest in similar income and net harvesting are basically flat at a very high level, so our investment colleagues in AIM are doing a very nice job. Where's pricing going? Page 27. We are still operating in a very benign pricing environment, and we expect some additional price movements, particularly in Germany, for the remainder of the year, but also in other markets. We should see more pricing strength coming through. The window is very important because if the economic slowdown continues, latest by the end of next year, you will see to start market share price wars again. Therefore, we need to take the pricing power now and bring it to the P&L. So much for my comments now on P&C. Let's already move on to life and health and give you the top news here. Revenues are essentially stable at 12.9 billion. Our operating asset base, which gives us the vast majority of the income, has grown again to 452 billion euros. Our net flows were also positive with 800 million, double that what we had in the prior year quarter, and operating profit is up 20% to 800 million. New business margin stands at 1.7% and the value of the new business exceeded 160 million. Now, page number 30 gives you an overview of the movements. We have stable premiums from IFRS products. The investment-oriented products, particularly VA, is coming down. That makes all the sense in the world, where you have a very high cost of hedging investment risk and where the interest rates are at record low, particularly in the U.S. On the German life side, you might have a question, why is that? We are really reinforcing a focus on margin. So we saw a particularly strong decline in single premium business from corporates and retail clients that suffering from low margin. I think that's exactly the right thing to do. And we had some negative effects in Asia Pacific. Here you still have the effects of Japan that we have closed down last year and very, very irrational competition in Taiwan through the bank assurance channel. And again, margin is here the focus and not the top line. In the U.S., the same. The VA market, given where interest rates are, is highly competitive, and we want to only write the business that we can make money on. The same is true for FIA. Given the spreads, we need to be very cautious on top line here. In terms of looking at profitability, the new business margin, as I said, is 1.7. Let me remind you, this is the beginning of the quarter assumptions. They obviously then over time get reflected, the lower rates get reflected in the margin. The present value of new business premiums was at 9.6 billion to explain the 163 million new business value. Page 32 give you the split of the value of new business margins, and I've added capital returns here. I thought it's quite interesting to see what our payback periods are. There's a lot of speculation, particularly on Germany, how long it takes to get the money back. It's just not true because we aren't able to leverage the RFB to fund the new business. And you can see also that we need to work on margins both in the U.S. and in particular in Western Europe, which is by and large France and Italy, and work is underway to make sure that we stabilize margins. We have good margins still in the German-speaking countries and very nice margins in the growth markets and in Iberia and Latin America, where a lot of the growth potential is. I mentioned that the operating asset base has grown to 452 billion. Page 33 gives you the various components. 800 million of that is coming from net flows. And it's particularly positive while we're still not happy with our top line in Italy and the flows, particularly from the bancassurance channel and the margins. It's better than last year. We're sort of coming back on track. We still had outflows in France, but all the other markets were positive and significantly improved over the prior year quarter. Operating profit is also very good. Page 34 gives you the movement analysis. The 821 benefit from improvement across all operating profit drivers, the technical result, the investment result, and the expense result are all up. So the margin on reserves for the quarter stood at 76 basis points, which is a very nice result. Let me move to the investment income, page 36. As I said, it's slightly higher than planned, and some of the harvesting benefits have been reflected. We had realized gains on debt of a total of 418 million. In particular, the Hartford debentures have been a big contributor with 256 million. So you will not see a repetition of that. If I may guide you overall, the operating profit for the segment at the upper end was 2.8 billion. If we normalize the first 6 months, we stand at almost exactly 50% of the upper range. So please don't get too much ahead of yourself in terms of operating profit forecast for the life and health segment. Now moving to MCV on page 37, the movement analysis needs three comments. Number one, the adjustments in the beginning reflect the anchoring of interest rates, in particular that we have done consistently with our internal model. We had a very strong in-force contribution of 1.2 billion that has been driving NCV up, and then economic variances in particular have been driven by a decline of the value of in-force of 2.3 billion due to significantly lower rates, and that was to be expected. Now, a comment on the so-called negative free surplus, it reflects our internal capital model. It doesn't reflect the Solvency II guidelines. We have an internal guideline of maintaining at least 130% of SCR, and the computation, therefore, is purely theoretical. So it doesn't mean that in a Solvency II environment we would have to adjust that money. We're just trying to be consistent according to MCV principles, which we at least still adhere to, between internal model and MCV reporting. So these would be my comments on the life and health side, and with that, I'd like to move on to the asset management section. Page 39 gives you the top messages, and I'd really like to point out this is outstanding performance again, and that in an environment that is not really conducive to asset management. Assets under management have grown again 15.9% to now a staggering 1.7 trillion euros. We have third-party net flows of more than 18 billion. The operating profit is up 20% to 600 million, and that's despite very low performance fees. And our cost-income ratio has improved to 57.6%. Now let's look at some of the facts in detail. Page number 40 gives you the movements of the AUMs, both for Allianz Group assets and third-party. All trends are positive here. The net flows are quite remarkable. Page 41 gives you the 18.6 in a flow. We talked about the fourth quarter. All the other numbers are very strong. And I can, without giving you details, tell you that just for the month of July, we had, again, a double-digit billion inflows into our asset management businesses. So the story continues despite the storm, and that's really, really important to understand because it's cash coming to Allianz and supports us in these very difficult market environment. Therefore, revenues have reached 1.5 billion, as you can see on page 42. And again, let me reiterate, it's not true that with increasing scale, the marginal profitability goes down. In our book, the opposite has been true. We've increased our third-party AUM margin from 39 basis points 2 years ago to now 41.9. So we're growing not just assets, not just top line, we're also growing the margins in the business. Page 43 gives you, therefore, the development of the operating profit that has reached 635 and been driven out of 197 increased net fee and commission income, and an operating expense base that has only grown by 87 million. Page 44 provides you with an overview of the key metrics for PIMCO. AUM in the new setup, which basically has separated the European business into what is PIMCO and has been PIMCO in the past, however, in the past through sub-mandates, into direct client access for PIMCO. They now stand at 1.4 trillion, had total net flows in the second quarter of 19.5, and a three-year outperformance for the first 6 months of 2012 of 96%. That's clearly an industry benchmark. Their operating profit stood at 543 million. I think that's outstanding in the scheme of things. Now, in terms of the net flows, you also need to understand this reflects both third-party flows and the internal flows. This is particularly important when we now look at Allianz Global Investors on page 45. Here we have in the new setup 291 billion in assets. We have a three-year outperformance of 56% and net flows of cumulatively 2.9 billion negative. However, third-party flows were much better than this number would suggest. We've had 1.1 billion negative flows, particularly on the equity side, that is better relative to the portfolios than what most of the market has done. And our operating profit stands at 97 million and a cost income ratio of below 70. I cannot promise you that it will stay below 70 as this is the target for the overall year, but we're clearly, given the excellent work of the team, on the right track in terms of productivity. So these were the messages on the three segments. So please let me summarize the message for the second quarter on page 47. We had a solid second quarter with total revenues of more than 25 billion, operating profit exceeding 2.4 and net income of 1.3, while maintaining a very strong balance sheet that we have further de-risked and will continue to de-risk to weather the storm. If you then look at delivery across the last 6 months, we've had more than 55 billion, 4.7 billion in operating profit and net income being up almost 40% to 2.8 billion. And therefore, we believe we're fully on track to achieve our outlook for the year of 8.2 billion plus or minus 500 million, given the usual caveats around NatCat and financial market conditions. And with that, I'm ready for your questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press the star or asterisk key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone. Please ensure that the mute function on your telephone is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. If you find that your question has already been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. We will pause for just a moment to allow everyone to signal. We will now take our first question from Martin Altena of ING. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, good afternoon, gentlemen. Three questions from my side. The first is on Germany. You witnessed a nice pickup in the German P&C premium growth after quite a difficult period. Should we see this as sustainable, or was it impacted by maybe also non-recurring items? The second is on U.S. Life. I witnessed here a reversing trend in the U.S. new business margin, likely on the back of successful repricing and redesigning actions. What should we expect here going forward, and at what level will you be satisfied? And the last question is on economic solvency. One of your peers earlier announced a relief on economic solvency stemming from the U.S. equivalents. How will you ultimately capitalize your U.S. franchise, and will it be under U.S. capital requirements, or would you just stick to your internal capital model that might not allow for this capital relief?
Thank you for the questions, and good afternoon to you. Let me start with the last one. We do not comment on any of our peers, but we would not use U.S. equivalents in our model. We haven't done so. It will also not have a very significant impact on our numbers because it particularly affects the variable annuity business, which is not the vast part of it. And for being applying equivalence, we first have to see what Solvency II finally brings us. It's totally up in the air now. So as we said in the first quarter, we've given it our best shot based on current draft of the statutes, but we're not applying any things that provide further relief on the numbers. Therefore, we wanted to show you how the movements translate. Now, that directly correlates to the second question you had. Where's the U.S. life business? The VA business is very difficult to do if interest rates are basically at zero and the capital markets are very volatile because the riders are very expensive to hedge. Therefore, margins are low, and we need to make sure that product design give us cost of capital under all circumstances. With the margins that we've had at the end of the second quarter, we're comfortably covering cost of capital, but we need to maintain repricing action in order to make sure that that happens under all circumstances. And we will continue to let volume go if that is not feasible. Now, the question on Germany, no, I don't expect this to be a one-off. We expect further positive pricing action and further momentum, particularly on the pricing side. And we're also seeing some volume growth now in various elements of the business model. So this is not a one-off.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will now take our next question from Vinit Malhotra of Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Hi. Just on this economic solvency, I noticed that between the 195 we had in the first week of May and the 178 now, it seems that it's not really the level per se, but the volatility in interest rates that is hurting here a bit. But could you just share some thoughts on how you perceive this, or how volatility has harmed the solvency or impacted the solvency now, and just any thoughts here? That's the first thing. Second thing is in Italian combined ratio, if you exclude the Nat Cat, it's a pretty strong number in the mid-80s. Is this something that is just the double whammy of price increase plus frequency fall? So that's really the question. And lastly, I'm sorry, I couldn't really understand the... you mentioned something about the life and health guidance, and you mentioned 50% or something. If you just clarify that. Thank you.
Yes, of course, Philip. I'd be very happy to do so. Now, the first one on the movement of the economic solvency for everybody, the question was, when we had the call on May 7th, how do we move that? It's very, very easy to understand. We've had, we obviously model the euro swap rates as a risk-free curve, and they have dropped significantly, particularly at the long end. At the same time, swap volatilities have shot up across all term structures. On top of that, we have seen for the Europe-based sovereigns the spreads widening, and this really drives the level of both risk capital and the reduction of the AFR, in addition to what I had said about the redemption of the hybrid capital of 1.7 billion. So it's an easy move to understand. Now, the Italian combined ratio is very low because of the very consequent portfolio cleaning that we have done. And it's really funny because when I sit here, I get signs from 15 directions to answer a question I know how to answer myself. So if we can please cut that a little bit. The issue is very clear. We've had very strong price action and very, very strong portfolio actions in the past 2 years, which are strongly paying off now because, indeed, frequency has been falling. So it provides an additional benefits. But it's very important that we have been also culling the worst performing segments before anybody else has. So with the overall price improvements in the market, we are now having a very distinctive level of profitability, despite the earthquake in Italy that, by the way, not just has hit the Italian operations, but also AGCS. Yeah, so we are at record profitability for Italy at this point in time. Now, this will obviously not stay this way because we already see some competitors taking pricing action on the way down. So this, my expectation is this will not continue to last for the market overall. However, I believe we have the strongest portfolio at this point in time because on top of the combined ratio being low, we have also the strongest reserve position in the industry. Now, on the guidance point, what I wanted to say is the following. If you were just to extrapolate the operating profits for the second quarter to the year end, you would easily exceed the upper end of the range that we have been providing for the life segment, which was 2.8 billion. If you normalize the investment gains that we had in the second quarter, you get to, for the total year, to about 2.8, 2.9 billion, which is exactly the upper end of the range, but not more. Yeah, so I don't want expectations to get too much ahead.
Yeah, that's very clear. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Philip.
We will now take our next question from Michael Huttner of JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks a lot and great numbers. I had a couple of questions. One on Fireman's Fund. Can you explain a little bit how far you are in terms of cleanup or restructuring and how much longer and how much more costs we should see from that? Combined ratio of 120 was a bit unexpected. Related to that, maybe you could say something about crop insurance. And then my other question is also on numbers. The in the corporate segment, the number dropped from Q1 was 284 to Q2 192. I was probably not listening enough in Q1 what happened, but is 192 now the new level for this cost center? Thank you.
Okay, so a couple was literally two questions. Thank you very much, Michael. The on Fireman's Fund, two items, where are we on the reserving? As you remember, we've instituted a very comprehensive reserve review program that I've been reporting about over the last year, starting with asbestosis and environmental, where we strengthened the reserves very strongly after 5 years not having updated that. And then we moved on to the other lines. We have now completed construction defects, and the open item is workers' compensation, which we will complete in the third quarter of this year. And that should, by and large, address all of the reserve positions in the U.S. Why workers' compensation? Inflation, medical inflation, particularly in the states in the U.S. that have suffered from budget shortfalls, have tried to push up a lot and push a lot of the medical cost into the workers' compensation insurers. So medical inflation has moved from an average long-term 3-4% to 14%. And we have spent a lot of time to think through what the medium-term expected inflation ought to be. And again, we'll conclude by the end of the third quarter. What we're also doing is our annual review of asbestosis reserves. All the good companies that I know do an annual review will do another one this year. So we will know by the end of the third quarter what the reserves position are. And to be honest, the 120 should have not surprised you because I already gave you in the first quarter clear indication that we would continue to strengthen reserves throughout the year. Now, in terms of the crop business, to be honest, I don't know the answer yet. The only thing I know, and you've also read in the press, that we have one of the harshest drought the United States has seen in the last 20 years. There's lots of estimates about what's going to happen. Based on where we are, these numbers can oscillate 50 million up and down. I cannot give you a precise number at this point in time. We will know more in the third quarter. In terms of the corporate segment, we had in the last quarter some significant value adjustments and therefore also going through operating profit. So for the year, we've said it's between 800 and a billion, typically negative. We are doing a little better than planned at this point in time. Is that good enough?
On the crop insurance, plus or minus 50, but what's the middle number?
Pick your best estimate, then you know better than me. But okay. I'll tell you in the third quarter.
Thank you.
We will now take our next question from Spencer Horgan of Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Three hopefully fairly quick ones. The first one is to follow on from Vinit's question on the combined ratio in Italy. Can you just clarify how much of that is driven by prior year reserves versus the accident year number? And then I guess the same in the US. I think if we look at the combined ratios, you mentioned that you mentioned last time round there's more to come on reserves than there still is. But the accident year number, I guess, is still also significantly above 100%. So, I mean, is there any hope that that comes below 100% on an accident year basis over the coming quarters? And then the last one is, in Italy on the life insurance side, obviously, I mean, you mentioned this briefly, we had quite significant net outflows in Q1, and that seems to have neutralized in Q2. Could you just sort of elaborate on what's driven that recovery and what the outlook is there? Thank you very much.
Spencer, I hope you're well and enjoying the Olympics. Let me start with the last question, Italy life. We had obviously significant pressure last year and in the beginning of this year because our main banking partner was focusing on improving its liquidity and pushing new business into its deposit products. We have intensively worked with the branches at the bank in order to improve the new business production, and that you see already in the numbers. On top of that, we have been allocated more branches from a competitor that has dropped out. So that is explaining the better numbers in Italy. Are we happy yet? No, we're not happy yet. We have to do further improvements also in terms of profitability and the guarantee design. But we are on a very good way. In terms of, we do not disclose individual runoffs per country, but I can tell you that there is not a big driver in terms of runoff that is making the numbers in Italy look artificially good. The underlying profitability is just outstanding. Now, the second question, sorry, I haven't understood. What was that about, the 100% combined ratio?
Well, that was in the U.S. I think, if I understand correctly, the reserve additions there were 90 million or so. So there, I guess, yes. The accident year combined ratio is also still above 100%. And the question is basically, do we expect it to go below 100% excluding reserve additions over the coming quarters, or what's the outlook there?
The question is over how many coming quarters. For this year, we still are suffering from the weak pricing environment in commercial lines. The private lines are doing very well. Those that are in personal lines are doing very well and have seen, and you see that in the publications. Commercial lines is only slowly moving. We're taking about 4% price. That is not good enough in order to bring us below 100%, and the next two quarters need to see significant price increases in order to get us below 100. I don't expect that for the next two quarters yet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Spencer.
We will now take our next question from John Hocking of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. I've got three questions, please. You mentioned, Oliver, that you're taking down some of the financials exposure in the second quarter. I wonder if you could give a little bit more color about that. Is it certain countries, certain parts of the capital structure? Secondly, if you could give a current view on what's going on with the Solvency II process, it would be appreciated. And then finally, given the margins in Italy on the general insurance side and your comments about appetite for volume in previous quarters, could you give us a little bit of an update, please, about where you see the trade-off between margins and volumes in Italy in particular? Thank you.
Yeah. Obviously, I'll start with the third question. On Italy, we need to grow, and we have enough profitability to support that, so we're pulling all the triggers to drive profitable growth. But the issue is that a number of tariffs in the market are not efficient. So there's a huge divide between the profitable segments and the unprofitable available clients. So it's easier said than done that you just reduce prices and then see the number of clients go. On the Solvency II process, I wish I knew. To be very frank, there is now a summer break and people will reconvene in September. What we do know that the long-term package will get tested in a QIS6. The specifications are ongoing. There will be tests, particularly with regards to the CCP and the matching adjustments that are specified now. My personal estimate is that these tests will take the vast majority of the remainder of the year, and then there will be a review of the outcomes in the first quarter of 2013. Therefore, there's a significant chance of a further delay in Solvency II implementation to be expected. We are, as you, very excited to understand what is happening. By the way, a final comment, Olli Schmidt just gave me the correct hint. In terms of what we are doing in Italy, we have a very, very good presentation from our Italian team that we've delivered to our Capital Market Day in Milan a couple of days ago. So they give you a couple of hints on where the margins are and how they have developed. And if you have further questions, Olli Schmidt and team will be happy to point out the relevant slides. Now, in terms of the financial exposures, I would be very unhappy to point out to ongoing sort of selling and buying actions. We don't want to do that, as you can imagine. The general story is what I've been telling you the last 18 months, which is we have been had a double-edged sword in our balance sheet, that is exposure to the banking sector in particular through equity subordinated and other papers, and at the same time on the interest rate side due to the ALM mismatch. And whenever the banking sector goes down, the central banks have been flooding the markets with liquidity, hitting us twice. Now, starting to hedge against the low interest rate by buying derivatives is not what we like. We'd rather like to lengthen the duration. That's easier said than done given the large portfolios, but we have been consequentially doing that, for example, bringing up the duration of our German asset book by almost a year in over the course of the last year. At the same time, we have been either hedging or selling out of our so-called strategic participations, as they've been a key part of the concentration risk. We've talked a lot about Commerzbank, for example. We've mentioned that we sold the Hartford warrant and the debentures, and these types of activities will continue to go on, and you will see further de-risking. But again, please excuse me, I do not want to give any leads to the market of where we are selling and where we are buying.
Okay, thank you. Can I just come back quickly on the Solvency II point? On Quiz 6, is that going to be a broad Quiz 6? It was going to be a Quiz 6 specifically on those two issues you mentioned in terms of CCP and matching adjustment.
It's going to be a QI6 on the long-term guarantee package, so it will include anything and everything that is needed in order to allow the industry to continue to sell products with long-duration guarantees and pension products.
Okay, so it seems quite tight timing to get that done by the end of the year, so when will the specification be published, do you think?
In September, the idea is to have the specs published in September. EIOPA is working on it. They will have a proposal ready by the end of the month, and then it goes to the Commission. We are involved in, from an industry perspective, in helping EIOPA to get it done as quickly as possible.
Okay. Thank you very much. Very helpful.
Of course.
We will now take our next question from Andy Wildfield of Barclays. Please go ahead.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you. A couple of points of clarification, actually. Just on the life guidance, and this should be quick, I think you said the normalized first half numbers was about half of the 2.8 on your calculation. So I'm just very simple mathematics, but what you're implying, if you're saying stick to the 2.8, is that the second half will be below the run rate that you've guided. Have I understood that right? That's the first question. And the second question, just on the equivalence issue again, which I thought was interesting from AXA this morning. I know you don't want to talk about the other companies, which is fine, but Aviva made a similar comparison when they took their U.S. business on a U.S. Statutory requirements, and it put 20-odd percentage points on their solvency, and given they have reasonable fixed income or equity indexed annuities, portfolio as well. I was just intrigued that you said that it doesn't make a lot of difference to you because it's really a VA problem, not on EIAs. So just a bit of clarity on the, not on the other companies, but just on whether there's anything I've missed in that. And just very, very, very quickly on Fireman's Fund, just on the construction and defects, is that a consequence of the sort of current economic climate? Is it business you've written? Is it stuff that's non-core? And are there other business lines that we should, if it's economic, are there other business lines in particular that you're worried about that may have that something that we should be looking at there?
Yes. Hi, Andy. Let me start with the last question, Fireman's Fund construction defect. It's actually an economic consequence because in the real estate slump in the U.S., people have been using every opportunity to increase the value of the houses, particularly those on sales. And it's very popular, particularly for new houses, to go back and to claim under the construction defect clause in order to do home repairs and home improvements. And the whole industry hasn't, from our experience, appropriately reserved against this development, as that could have not been forecast, as we're in the fourth year of a slump here in the U.S. Real estate market. In terms of equivalent, to be honest, I do not know the Aviva methodology, so I have to pass on this one. However, I know because when we looked at the AXA numbers today, we did the comparison, and again, I can tell you, for us, it would have been only about a 4% lift. I cannot comment on Aviva. I'm sorry. In terms of the life guidance, what I wanted to say is that this quarter, the level of realized gains on the fixed income side has been elevated above what the normalized level would be. So if you're trying to forecast what the overall year would, I would rather stick with our outlook a little, maybe a little better, but not double the number for the first 6 months. That would give you probably too high an estimate. Is that
okay? Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. Thank you very much.
Of course.
We will now take our next question from Julia Raffel of Autonomous. Please go ahead.
Hello, Julia.
Hello. Thank you very much. I have a few questions. First one is on your new business margin, which has fallen to 1.7%. I would have expected, given that you use start of quarter assumption, I would have expected margin not to fall, because if I compare the swap curve at the end of March with the swap curve at the end of 2011, interest rates didn't fall, and at the same time you have equity markets going up, spread coming in, and VIX declining. So I was just trying to have a bit of clarification as to why the new business margin fell. And my second question is on require capital. You explain in detail in the speech that, you know, the main driver were lower interest rates, volatility ticking up. I just would have thought that given that you released capital from having sold the venture of R4 and having de-risk in terms of like cross-border sovereign exposure, equity gearing, I would have expected some sort of offsetting. And so I just wonder how, if you can quantify for us what was the interest rate impact standalone. And my final question is on the U.S. Fixed annuity. When I read your interim statement, it seems that you sound more cautious on fixed index, and both in terms of volume prospect and in terms of profitability. Can you give any flavor on that? And is there any irrational competition in the fixed annuity space too? Thank you very much.
Okay, let me do the following. The second question in terms of rate movements on Olli Schmidt will answer after the call, because there are a couple of detailed numbers that you need. In terms of the new business margin question, in fact, what has been driving the new business margin went down 80 basis points. And let me go through the most important margins and how have they moved. There are basically three countries that have had a negative impact. The first one is the U.S. We had particularly significant declines both in VA and FIA new business margin, driven by the extreme drop in swap rates relative to the numbers we had seen before. So one is to look at the Europe, and one is to look within the U.S. In Italy, we had declining rates and increasing volatilities, in particularly driving up the cost for hedging options and guarantees. And that has been going on across all of our products. And that's why we are redoing them. In terms of Germany, we had an impact from declining rates and particularly from increasing volatility, and that's very important. While we had some benefits from reducing the guarantee level from 225 to 175, please don't forget in the first quarter we still had some after sales on the old guarantee products of 225 that now has moved to 175 environment. We had some positive effects as well that have helped us a bit, particularly in Asia-Pacific, because we have a lot of high-margin business coming now from Indonesia, and we had, as I said, reduced our volume in the low margin environment of Taiwan. So if you factor in all of these points, you get exactly to the 1.7. And again, for more detailed questions, Oli would be very happy to address that. Now, in terms of the FIA business, this is priced off of long-term rates. If the treasuries are at zero, it's very difficult to provide a lot of value to clients unless you charge them very high fees. So we need to see volumes coming down for this product as well, given the ultra low interest rate environment. And therefore, we need to be cautious to sell a product that is both good for the consumer and good for shareholders, and I expect the volumes to be significantly lower than the planning in the planning exercise we've done at the end of last year, given where rates are. And that, again, that's not just true for VA business, yeah? So I think it's really important. Now, what we've done in for July, we have done another round of repricing action both across VA and FIA, and we need to see how volumes respond to the repricing. You asked about irrational competition. I cannot tell you how rational or irrational people are. Some local competitors do not operate with a value-based pricing environment. They still work with deterministic interest rates, mean reversion assumptions that we don't share, and therefore whether it's irrational, I don't know, but they certainly use more aggressive pricing assumptions than we would allow ourselves to be using.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Of course.
We will now take our next question from William Hawkins of KPW. Please go ahead.
Hello, thank you very much. Two questions. My first question, Oliver, on your solvency ratio, I think you still have a deficit against the required capitalization for a AA using the S&P model. Could you give us an indication of what the size of that deficit may be? And to the extent that the answer is no, could you just remind me what the key differences are between the S&P model and your own? Because there's quite a stark difference between your own numbers showing that you're very, very comfortable and the implication of what they're saying, which is that it's less so. So if you could directionally help, that would be kind. And then secondly, sorry to come back to it, but in Fireman's Fund, are you guys planning on learning or learning any strategic lessons from what's going on? I mean, I've taken your guidance of what you've said, but it really sounds like we're now at the stage where Fireman's is just repeating the terrible mistakes that it made 10 years ago. I mean, this time last year you were talking about expense overruns, and that was all fair enough, but now you're talking about medical expense inflation and basic under-reserving and workers' compensation. You know, that's exactly what went wrong 10 years ago. So is there anything strategic going on in that country?
Okay, let me address that one. For you, it's Groundhog Day because you've been around a long, long time. I wasn't there, so I don't know what happened 10 years ago. But I can understand your frustration. But I have a very pragmatic answer. The pragmatic answer is even if I took a strategic lesson out of that, it doesn't help much at this point in time because asset prices are at record lows. Industry profitability in commercial lines is not good. So the real strategy, unfortunately, is fixing this thing, and then we worry about everything else later once it's on a good footing. So the productivity improvements are coming through, the cleaning up is happening, and we'll pursue that, and then we worry about the strategic consequences once we've seen how we come through the low point of the cycle. So sorry for that, but that's all I can tell you at this point in time. But since Michael has been here much longer than me, I think he's certainly taking the lessons out of this. Now, Will, the second point was around Solvency II and our internal model. Now, we're currently calibrating at a 50 basis point approach, and the AA rating is 3 basis points, so that's the first just level of confidence difference. The second point is the S&P model has a much more simplistic outside-in view, for example, on asset allocation and charges they do apply. There is no diversification benefits. And most importantly, they're taking the risk for the required funds before policyholder participation. So we're getting huge capital charges for the life business, particularly for the German business, where we are uniquely privileged because of our strong free RFB position and the management levers we have available. So, for example, the fact that we can move annual credits and annual crediting policy and put this into final bonuses, which is a economically dramatic step in terms of protecting capital is not echoed and mirrored in the S&P model. We're talking to them about that. We are in a process of getting so-called internal model approval, like for the other one, that will be finalized by the end of the year, we expect. So we hope to see some convergence between our internal model and this, the Standard & Poor's model. Now, as you already correctly assumed, I cannot give you the number, but I can tell you we're working very hard to keep that in the targets that S&P have set. Let me repeat that. They basically expect very strong earnings through the year, more than $7 billion. They expect us to maintain a capitalization comfortably about a single A level, for example. And all on all of these criteria, I can reassure you we're comfortably above where we need to be at this point in time.
Thanks very much.
We will now take our next question from Aaron Shea of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hi. If my line is on, it's Brian Shea. I'm not quite sure where Aaron came from. Can you guys hear me?
Yes. We can hear you really well. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
All right. All right. I just wanted to ask about your new money. What are you buying, and at what yield? I know sometimes when you've had this question in the past, you've given an answer that's maybe an average over a period, maybe a six-month period. It would be great, given how quickly things are moving, if you could give as current an answer as possible. I'd really appreciate that. And if possible, if you could also separate that into life and non-life. Thank you.
All right. I thought you wanted to ask me about the CFO forum and discipline around publication, but we'll probably do that later.
If that's an invitation, I will. Given us an Allianz call,
I'm just kidding. It bought me 10 seconds to address your yield question. Now, so talking about what we're doing on the life side, the new yields, we typically have that for the first 6 months total because we're obviously not only continuously investing, but we have some lump sum investments, for example, in real estate and others that are helping our yield. The overall new money yield for the first 6 months in life and health has been 3.7%. The P&C number has been 3.1%. Is that good enough and current enough? You know, that's very current for the insurance industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, if that's all you've got, I'll take it. I just sort of thought whatever you've got today will be very different from what new money you were getting in January. But if you don't have the information, that's fine.
Now, what I can tell you, however, is the following. It depends very much on the mix of investments that we can achieve. So we're trying to have less government and more covered. So, for example, let me go one step deeper on the life and health side. The yield has been 3.7. On the ABS, MBS side, we've had 3.9. On corporate, around 3.4, as well as on covered. The more good, high-quality ABS we can get, the higher the yield will be. And it also helps us on the duration side because the maturity is around 16 years. So we're really trying to get the numbers where they need to be. Now, in terms of the yields coming down, you're absolutely right. Over the course of the years, it would go down. I would expect that the last 3 months on the P&C side, the yield is down by about 10 basis points. And probably on the life side, it's between 10 and 20 basis points down, given the duration. Do I now get a bonus?
Okay. Thank you very much.
First, I was wondering whether you were asking where I'm putting my money, and it's all in real estate, by the way.
Not an Allianz. What?
Yeah, I have a lot of exposure in Allianz, my friend.
Thank you.
All right.
We will now take our next question from Mark Thiel of Mediobanca. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Two questions, please. One is, how do you think about the LIBOR investigations, both in terms of the potential losses as well as your appetite for writing D&O coverage? And then my second question is a bit of an understanding question of the life earnings. When I first saw the good numbers, I thought it was mainly driven by realized gains. But then looking at the sources of the results, there has been a very good result in the technical component. Actually, that's a peak number compared with the previous quarter. So I was wondering, are there one-offs in there, and what's the extent of that, and is the underlying closer to 200 million. Can you explain a bit the result sources here?
Yes, very happy to do so. Yes, there were some reversal in the quarter. The technical result for the first half year was around 400 million, and we're still targeting around 800 million for the total year. Yeah, if you're trying to update your spreadsheet, that's exactly where we want it to be. And this number has to seriously grow, I believe that the sources and the potential in the existing business model is more around a billion. In terms of the LIBOR side, let me start with the D&O question. We're obviously asking ourselves the question very intensively. AGC and S write significant D&O portfolios, even though much less than AIG and Zurich, for example, less than half. And we, at this point in time, we do not expect any net claims payments out of D&O claims around the LIBOR events. That's a firm statement. But again, that's only as firm as the next claim that comes around the corner. So that's the current assessment. In terms of our losses, we have also looked into this. And by the way, there is a German industry investigation, because we don't want to do it as individual insurers, but we're looking at it from the German Industry Association, whether there have been any significant losses and what we do about it. For we need to differentiate at Allianz between the money we manage on behalf of our insurance clients and our third-party assets. On the third-party asset side, we do not have assets that are directly tied to LIBOR and that have been suffering. On the internal side, we're typically balanced on the buy and the sell side, so there has been not a major loss, but we are investigating it, and we do not find it obviously funny what has happened. In particular, what is not good is the arising implication that it's not just the banks, but central banks being involved in this. That gives us really cause for concern.
So your appetite going forward would be unchanged, or?
Getting the right price for the risk as always.
Okay, thank you.
We will now take our next question from Nick Holmes of Nomura. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Thank you very much. Just a few questions, please. First one is apologies to come back yet again on this economic solvency, but you've made your position very clear on equivalence. I wanted to ask, could you remind us, what your position is on the matching premium and also on the counter-cyclical premium? Because, I think there are big differences between some companies in the way in which they calculate this for economic ratios. And, Oliver, I was just interested to know what the situation is for you. Then moving on to the life side, just wanted to ask, the technical result improved a lot in Q2. Was there a reserve release behind that? And then final question is, you said competition is still strong in U.S. life. You've elaborated on that in respect of equity index annuities. I wondered if you could say a few comments about variable annuities. Is that still extremely competitive? Thank you very much.
Yeah, let me start, Nick. How are you? Let me start with the U.S. We have seen a lot of product rationalization in the U.S., but given where interest rates have gone, from our perspective, it hasn't gone far enough. So you either see very low profitability or a lot of tail risks that company take by not appropriately hedging, in particular with regards to behavioral risk. I don't want to go into the details today, but around lapse assumptions in particular, there's a lot of risk in the system. In terms I didn't quite understand the Q2 reserve releases on the technical results. We had on the technical result on the life side, I assume that's what you're talking about.
Yes, it was on the life side, yes.
We had roughly a 30 million catch-up because of a too large a reserve in the French business in the first quarter, which
right.
We reversed in the second quarter. That had something to do with the legal environment in France, but that's the only movement that we really have, given the overall 400 million.
Yes.
And the other movements, that's a small one. What we're trying to do is to get the technical results more stable and, in particular, get them up. And we are slowly but surely moving. In terms of economic solvency and what is our interpretation, and if you remember the Q1 publications, we have provided a very detailed explanation of what we've done on the model. We focused all our model changes of the last quarters into Q1. I haven't done any this quarter, and we're not planning any for the next quarter in order to provide you all with more stability and not just move numbers up and down.
Yes.
We have, on the risk capital side, just to be more precise on the U.S., have implemented in the risk capital, not on the available financial resources side, which is very important, had put in an assumption about stock scenarios for the U.S., for Switzerland and Korea. We have, on the AFR side, stuck to consequently to the environment that we've had in the past, that's the liquidity premium that is agreed by the CFO forum. So no special ways for Allianz here.
Can you just clarify, with both the matching premium and the countercyclical premium, are you actually implementing the CFO proposals for the Solvency II project, which haven't yet actually been agreed, have they?
No, the answer is no, because there's too much speculation around what is going to happen. By the way, it's not just we have an industry package for the first time that the whole industry buys into, but we've also said we will only implement a matching adjustment once it's been approved. You know that there is huge resistance in Germany to the application. We don't know to what product it's going to be applied. Will there be a narrow approval or a wide approval? What we have agreed to, what was tested in QIS5, was the liquidity premium that we have applied according to industry standards and will continue to do so until we have clarity around what the rules will be. This will be not before the end of the QIS6 testing, and before there is clarity, and that I expect earliest at the middle of next year. Everything else would be. We actually have become, if you look back to the last quarter, become more cautious. Just to give you an example, under Solvency II, it should not matter for group solvency where the capital is housed, and capital within Europe should be mobile, but we're finding increasingly that local regulators in crisis scenarios put a dampener on that. That's why the last time we've said the value that is a value of in-force and life, we do not assume to be fungible anymore, and have taken more than a 15% deduction on our solvability to just not kid ourselves in terms of movement. Yeah, so we're trying to be extremely conservative and not having to have negative surprises once the final rules come out.
Yeah, that's very clear. One very last quick question. If the matching premium and countercyclical premium was to be implemented by the Solvency II project in the way in which the CFO forum envisages, would that have a material positive impact on your economic solvency ratio?
Yes, it would be very, very positive.
It would be very positive, would it?
Yes,
okay.
Because in particular, because we have very stable liabilities. Remember, the matching adjustment, the way we have proposed it, has two components. One is to take care of the fact in terms of computing credit spread risk of the illiquidity of the liabilities. But the second one is also to take into account what liquidity buffers we do have on the asset side. True, ALM requires you to look at both. So if you have in Germany, for example, 160 billion in assets, and out of which you have maybe, let's say, 5 or 10 billion in spread product, and you have 10 billion or 20 billion in cash equivalents, I don't care about the credit spread movements, because even under mass lapse assumptions, I will never be in the position to having to sell spread product at a loss. So if we get appropriate regulation, it would incentivize the creation of both illiquid liabilities and the appropriate management of cash reserves, very much like you see it now under Basel III. And this is not where we are. And to be honest, Allianz, because we have very prudent ALM management, is suffering more than others for being conservative on our cash management position.
Okay. Thank you very much, Oliver.
We will now take our next question from Michael Haid of MainFirst. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Two questions. First on P&C pricing. 2% price increases across the group is pretty much the same as in the first quarter. And I understand this is after a bonus and a malus and rebates and so on. Is it sufficient to offset claims inflation? And is it also fair to assume, as your wording suggested, that the accident year loss ratio excluding NatCat remains below 70% going forward? And second question, the inevitable question in my view, the operating profit target for this year. You achieved 4.7 billion in the first half. If I take the normalized midpoint, 50% of it, 4.1 billion, so you get above your target upper end, 8.8 billion. Is it fair to say that under normal conditions you are heading for the upper end of the target operating profit for this year?
Michael, I wish I would know. We are confident to make our targets, but you know, don't forget Q3 is typically NatCat season. Yeah, there are significant things that can happen. We still are in an environment where we have no idea what happens to the euro. Just look at the last 3 days, what has happened there. So we remain cautious. And by the way, if we were deciding to take even more risk out of the balance sheet, that might come at some cost, because actually reducing some exposures might come at even at operating losses. So we want to hit our targets, but we don't want to get realistic at this point in time. In terms of the pricing, the first thing is to say we have actually reduced prices in credit insurance, which has a negative impact on this percent. Without that, we are at about 2.5 percentage points. Then you have two drivers. One is severity side, but you also have frequency dropping in a number of markets due to the decline in economic activity, which should also help. But you're right, we need to take price, and we need to take more price, and we will probably take more price than you have on the chart already. There's a number of pricing actions that are already in the works that are not yet on the page.
Okay, thank you. But coming back to the first question, if I may, the operating profit target. The third quarter net cat is budgeted in your target, so that is normal, if you like. And is there anything else that we should take into account as a burden for the second half that is already foreseeable, or is it just an eventuality that it could be worse, the second half than the first?
No, Michael, we have not anything specific, but we'll have less dividends. Again, there will be capital market volatility, then major things that can happen, so we don't want to speculate too much. Yeah, I can tell you about the here and now, but given this environment, I feel hard-pressed to give a forecast. That's more. By the way, I'd like to remind you, most of our competitors don't even have an outlook.
No, perfect. Thank you very much.
As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star 1.
But you don't have to press star 1.
If you find your question has already been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. We will now take our next question from Wolfgang Packenstein of ADP AG. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my questions. A key problem to this ugly European debt crisis is the extreme cautious stance of the private sector investors, including the funds and insurance companies, in support of sovereign sector debt in general. The ECB seems to want to find a way out of this terrible trap, and if we were to believe Draghi yesterday, then the ECB has drawn a line in the sand, which was to say if Spain submits itself to the EFSF, which is effectively a bailout, then the ECB will really step in a way different shape and form than ever before. My question is, if the ECB was to step into the markets to intervene, which then essentially means that Spain has asked for a bailout, would you as a key market investor decide to reduce and cut further sovereign debt in Europe in general, or would you finally consider this factor a step on the road to stabilize Europe and increase sovereign exposure in general? My second question is, with interest rates in general apparently negative and many well-rated sovereigns, will you keep the asset allocation in equities as low as it is right now, or will you respond in shifting parts of that asset allocation? And thirdly, in the United States, the fiscal cliff does supposedly constitute at least as big a risk as the European debt crisis. Going forward, will your portfolio be under increased stress if that was to materialize, or is that neutral for your portfolio? Thank you.
An asset manager asking for tips. Okay.
No, not really. A big stock investor being scared.
I can imagine. And many of us, including us, are. Let me start with the first one. We obviously cannot tell you what, given that we are Europe's largest investor, what we do in terms of buying and selling under certain circumstances. Yeah?
You did say that before, right?
Yeah, but so the key thing is really the following. It's not just about what the debt dynamics are and whether Spain gets a bailout. One of the key problems we have with government debt is what has happened in the PSI with Greece. That number one, first, governments came to us and says, please hold on to Greek debt. We'll find a solution. And then April, a few months later, they say, we'll take all of your money, but we keep ours. And then on top, and by the way, please recapitalize local units if you have any of them. And that is not something that we can tell to our investors, and therefore we will cannot buy as much government debt as we'd like to, because we're running serious problems. We do not know what seniority level we have, and that's just not true for government alone for the government debt. The same is for bank debt. You think you're buying a senior bond, then they get pledged assets to the ECB, and suddenly you turn out to be very junior. Then somebody issues a paper like Mr. Barnier and says, why don't we have the holders of debt pay for all of the problems, and that we save some money for taxpayers. And in this environment, we need to say, okay, then find somebody else to do the jobs, because we need clear risk-return trade-offs in order to be able to justify investing in a certain asset class. And that is not the case anymore, because after the fact, people can change what you consider to be legal arrangements. Yeah, and that's not very good. I have the other day heard from a very serious person, this is like in Argentina, in Venezuela, and other places, this is a banana republic. And in this environment, we need to be very, very cautious. So what has to happen, to be put it more positively, we need to have more precise guidelines, both on terms of banking bailouts and government debt. What is it that we can actually expect, and how senior are we, and what is the burden sharing between the public institutions that are at risk here, particularly the ECB and all kinds of other forms, and private investors? If this is moving around, we have no way to assess risk and therefore price for the appropriate returns. That's why you do not have rates that are as high, because people, they think that's the true risk-adjusted return expectations. It's just a buyer strike. We cannot buy in many instances under all circumstances because we're not clear of what happens. That's why Mario Draghi, by the way, yesterday said they need to revisit the issue around seniority and where private investors come out relative to public money provided. Again, the PSI in Greece was the worst case, and we cannot have something like this ever again in the Eurozone. Now, in terms of what do we do in the investments, and do we go into equities? To be honest, we would want to have more equities, but we can't. Both our regulatory environment and the accounting environment does give us strong disincentives to invest in equities. We take all the volatility without getting the appropriate benefits. And the third one is the fiscal cliff in the U.S. Yes, we agree. It's totally underestimated the degree to which the U.S. is exposed, but the markets are currently not focusing on it. That's why, since we are a very big client of PIMCO, not just for our insurance money, but generally also for advice, we take a very cautious view relative to U.S. treasuries.
Thank you.
So we have time for one or two last questions.
We will now take a question from Jochen Schmidt of Metzler Equities. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I have one question on your German P&C operations. If I got you right, you said that the pricing environment might deteriorate till year-end 2013. I guess this was a general statement rather than Germany-specific, but nevertheless, my question is, would this give you enough time to reduce the combined ratio in your German operations as planned? Thank you.
Yeah, it was targeted to the overall portfolio. My personal expectation would be that the pricing environment for Germany will be more positive than for many of the other markets. There are two drivers for that. Number one, the economic environment is still more benign than, for example, in Italy or even in Spain. Second, the pressure from the low rates is particularly strong in Germany. Third, the combined ratios, particularly in motor, have been extremely high, and there's a lot more needed in order to bring it online.
Thank you.
We will now take our final question from Athanasio Pantarotas from Cheuvreux. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. I have just one question left. It regards your life German business. Is it correct to affirm that using the interest rate environment, the current interest rate environment, your new business value should be at break-even or even slightly below? And are you going to cut your the guaranteed rate in next years in the life new business German production? Thank you.
The second thing I cannot answer for legal reasons. Our life company does make a decision on what the crediting rates are for the next year. My current assumption would be if rates remain where they are, that crediting rates are expected to go down. They have to go down, but we can't tell you by how much at this point in time. But the laws of physics will clearly hold.
In Sorry, the crediting rate or the guaranteed rate? Or both?
The guaranteed rates we do not decide. The mm-hmm. guaranteed rates, what happens is the maximum guarantee rate that's set by the government, yeah, as a maximum guarantee, which is currently at 175, and the government may decide to bring that down further. Typically, the companies in the market all stick to that guaranteed level. Now, in terms of the, as you saw, our current numbers and the new business margin, they still stand comfortably at 2.7% for the German-speaking country. So we have some way to go before we get to cost of capital, even under current interest rates.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Everybody happy out there? One urgent question not answered. Please speak now. Otherwise, I wish you all a lot of fun with the Olympics. For those of you that have been on holidays, all the best. I'm disappearing tomorrow, and I'd like to see you all back after the summer in good health, and thanks for supporting us. Mr. Yeah. Schmidt?
Thanks to everybody for joining the call. We wish you a very nice remaining afternoon and a pleasant weekend. Goodbye.